above and beyond the sort of mythological aspect of hunters' habits, personal, professional, whether it be violence, drugs, etc., large expense accounts, there are seven main characteristics that appear throughout Hunter's writing, and these kind of vary depending on the time frame. This is also off gonzo.org, The Beginnings and Concept of Gonzo Journalism by Christine Othitis. She lists overlapping themes of sex, violence, drugs, sports, and politics, quotations by famous people and other writers, sometimes his own, references to public figures, a tendency to move away from the topic subject or subject he began with, the use of sarcasm and/or vulgarity as humor, a tendency for the words to flow in an extremely creative use of the English language, and lastly, and I feel most importantly, an extreme scrutiny of situations. I'm going to share a little bit here from an article Hunter wrote for Rolling Stone, Fear and Loathing Campaign 2004, The Fun Hogs in the Passing Lane. Did you see Bush on TV trying to debate? Jesus, he talked like a donkey with no brains at all. Bush went belly up less than halfway through his first bout with Kerry, who hammered poor George into jelly. I almost felt sorry for him until I heard someone call him Mr. President, and then I felt ashamed. Karl Rove felt even worse. Rove has a nasty little problem, and its name is George Bush. The president failed miserably from the instant he got on stage. He looked weak and dumb, and that is Rove's problem. His candidate is a weak-minded frat boy who cracks under pressure in front of 60 million viewers. Immediately after the first debate ended, I called Muhammad Ali at his home. But whoever answered said the champ was laughing so hard he couldn't come to the phone. The debate really cracked him up, he chuckled. The champ loves a good ass-whooping. He says Bush looks so scared to fight, he finally just quit and laid down. Presidential politics is a vicious business, even for rich white men, and anybody who gets into it should be prepared to grapple with the meanest of the mean. The White House has never been seized by timid warriors. Every GOP administration since 1952 has let the military-industrial complex loot the treasury and plunge the nation into debt on the excuse of a wartime economic emergency. Nixon comes quickly to mind, along with Reagan and his ridiculous trickle-down theory. Republicans have never approved of democracy, and they never will. It all goes back to pre-industrial America, when only white male property owners could vote. Things haven't changed all that much where George W. Bush comes from. Houston is a cruel and crazy town on a filthy river in East Texas with no zoning laws and a culture of sex, money, and violence. It's a shabby, sprawling metropolis ruled by brazen women, crooked cops, and super-rich pansexual cowboys who live by the code of the West. Houston is also the unnatural home of two out of the three last presidents of the United States of America, for good or ill. The other was a handsome, sex-crazed boy from next-door Arkansas, which has no laws against oral sex or any other deviant practice not specifically forbidden in the New Testament, including anal incest and public cunnilingus with farm animals. The genetically vicious nature of presidential campaigns in America is too obvious to argue with, but some people call it fun, and I am one of them. Election day is always a wild and terrifying time for political junkies, and I am one of those too. We look forward to major election days like sex addicts look forward to orgies. We are slaves to it. Which is not a bad thing, all in all, for the winners. I look at elections with the cool and dispassionate gaze of a professional gambler, especially when I'm betting real money on the outcome. Contrary to conventional wisdom, I see Kerry with 5 points as a recommended risk. Kerry will win this election, if it happens, by a bigger margin than Bush finally gouged out of Florida in 2000. That was about 46%, plus 5 points for owning the U.S. Supreme Court, which seemed to equal 51%. Nobody really believed that, But George W. Bush moved into the White House anyways. It was the most brutal seizure of power since Hitler burned the Reichstag in 1933 and declared himself the new boss of Germany. Karl Rove is no stranger to Nazi strategy, if only because it worked. Richard Nixon looks like a flaming liberal today compared to a golem like George Bush. If Nixon were running for president today, he would be seen as a liberal candidate, and he would probably win. He was a crook and a bungler, but a barrel of laughs compared to this gang of thugs from the Halliburton Petroleum Organization running the White House today. Nixon was a professional politician, and I despised everything he stood for. But if he were running for president this year against the evil Bush-Cheney gang, I would happily vote for him. You bet. Nixon was my man. He was a crook and a creep and a gin sot. But on some nights, he would get hammered and wander around the streets. He was fun to hang out with. We would get in a cab and cruise over to the Watergate Hotel, just for laughs. The question this year is not whether President Bush is acting more and more like the head of a fascist government, but if the American people want it that way.
To the sea, not to die but to be reborn, away from the land so battered and torn. Forever. Oh, say, can you see it's really such a mess? Every inch of earth is a fighting list. Giant pencil and lipstick tube shaped flames continue to rain and cause screaming pain. And the Arctic stains from silver blue to bloody red as our feet find the sand and the sea. Is straight ahead.
Certified Mail, May 17, 1985. As you know, I have spoken with you on the telephone on two occasions recently about the constant disturbances from your tenant who lives below us. We listen to the loud music, loud playing of the television, arguing in loud voices, apparent beatings, and a person screaming for approximately 1 month before I called you to complain about the noise. During our first discussion, you reacted in what I consider to be a very condescending manner when I informed you of the disturbances. I find his disturbances frightening to listen to, and the only reason I have not called the police department to report the screaming is that once the police left the house, after responding to the call, we would have been left with your tenant as a neighbor. There is no insulation between where we live and where he lives, and when we are sleeping in the upstairs bedroom, it sounds as though the arguments and beatings are happening in our living room. When we had our second discussion about the same subject, you told me that he had been told about the noise. However, the situation has not improved. The loud arguments have always occurred at between approximately 3:30 a.m. and 4:30 a.m., with the exception of one evening this week when a loud argument started at 8:15 p.m. The very worst thing about having this man for a neighbor is the noise and the violence that surround him. But we are also experiencing much difficulty with the parking situation. Whenever he is here, we have problems with the huge Jeep he drives. The huge Jeep he drives being parked in the area in front of the gate. We cannot see clearly enough to safely enter the avenue, assuming that he leaves enough space for us to back the car out. To sum it all up, we are finding life at the house since this person moved in to be intolerable. We spend as little time as possible at the house. We only sleep here when he keeps quiet enough to allow such sleep. We spend no time at all at the house on weekends if we can possibly help it. The parking difficulties are a problem. We can only assume from the fact that nothing has been done by you as the landlord about the unpleasant situation we find ourselves in that you have very little concern for our comfort at the house. It also appears that nothing you say to your other tenant will change matters in any way. We have consulted an attorney who has advised us to notify you by way of this letter of our last day at the above premises. This letter is also to demand the return of the $4,000 security deposit which we paid to your agent via certified mail, May 23, 1985. Enclosed is a copy of a book by your tenant, the, quote, author. I am sure you have not read it, otherwise you would never have let this person move into your house. The very best thing about this book is that it can be read from cover to cover in a very short period of time, and therefore one does not have to invest much of one's time in reading it. You will particularly enjoy his descriptions of all the drugs he takes, the weapons he enjoys, and how he likes to damage hotel rooms and leave without paying the bills. I have told you in our telephone conversations that I had never heard of him, and you assured me that he was a very well-known writer. With some difficulty, I finally did find a copy of this book. I am amazed at how accurately I described him when I told you that he sounds like a crazy person who is on drugs and more than likely armed. This turns out to be an interesting observation, as this is very close to the way he describes himself. Incidentally, the banging and screaming occurred again last night. These are intercepted letters to the landlord complaining about Hunter Thompson's alleged behavior the last time he moved down the mountain temporarily. Again, Songs of the Doomed. And that's really what I'm going to have time for in the context of sharing writings and such with you. If you would like to speak regarding what Hunter Thompson meant to you, impact he had on your life, maybe you saw him speak. I have here. You can't see it, but it's my Ticketron ticket for when I was going to go see Hunter Thompson with a good friend, April 15th, I believe, 1990. And, well, let's just say in true fashion, we got too messed up to actually get to the gig.
Yeah, but Hunter Thompson came here to Portland, and when Hunter Thompson was here several years ago at speaking about 15 years ago at the First Congregational Church, it was $10 a ticket, and as I recall, I thought Hunter Thompson wouldn't pay $10 to go hear him speak. So what I did was I put on a courier uniform, FedEx uniform, and I got an overnight letter envelope and a small bottle of Wild Turkey, and I delivered it to him. They wanted to accept it at the door, and I said, "I'm sorry, are you Hunter Thompson?" And they said, "No." So, well, I need him to sign for this, so I followed him inside. Thompson looked very paranoid in the inner sanctum of this church, And I said, Mr. Thompson? He said, yes. And he signed for this overnight envelope and went inside and went and heard him speak.
Excellent. Daniel Flesses, host of The Outside World, where this Friday at midnight, you can hear several hours worth of recollections.
Yeah, we'll continue with the uncensored version of a lot of the writings that Andrew's piled around himself here. It's a mess, folks.
Yeah, and there's just stuff we can't read before 10 p.m., so we'll go to the phones now. Good morning. You are on KABU.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I would like to read from a review by Kurt Vonnegut Jr. that he did. It's called A Political Disease. It's about his admiration for Hunter S. Thompson, and there's a call for what we can do in his honor.
Okay, just keep it short. There's a bunch of other people, and we only got 9 minutes.
Right? Oh, okay, then I'll just read about half of it. Let's see.
And clean.
All right. Let's see. He is that rare sort of American author who must be read. He makes exciting, moving collages of carefully selected junk. They must be experienced. They can't be paraphrased. As for the truth about his health, I have asked around about it. I am told that he appears to be strong and rosy and steadily sane. But we will be doing what he wants us to do, I think, if we consider his exterior a sort of Dorian Gray facade. Inwardly, he is being eaten alive by tin-horn politicians. The disease is fatal. There is no known cure. The most we can do for the poor devil, it seems to me, is to name his disease in his honor. From this moment on, let all those who feel that Americans can be as easily led to beauty as to ugliness, to truth as to public relations, to joy as to bitterness, be said to be suffering from Hunter Thompson's disease. I don't have it this morning. It comes and goes. This morning I don't have Hunter Thompson's disease.
Me neither.
Thank
you very much for that reading.
Thanks, Miss.
All right.
For that tribute.
Bye. Okay, and now you're on the air.
Is this me?
It is you.
Right on. I wanted to just share a little something. It was about in 1974, I was 20 years old, and Hunter was a total role model to me. And I was pretty crazy, and I'd spent a whole night up on Mexican Reds, which were Seconal. And I remember getting up in the morning. I lived in a little house on the Washington-Idaho border, and I had 37 hits of LSD. And I thought, oh, man, let's just take all of them, you know. So I swallowed them with some water and had friends come by all day. And I started feeling like I was getting high, and then all of a sudden I had reached this plateau. And I had told all my friends. They asked me what I was doing. I said, I'm tripping, man. And they said, what'd you do? And I told them. And after that day, my friends actually made a betting pool that I would not live to be 25 years old. But anyway, yeah, I miss Hunter.
Yeah, he is missed widely. I've actually...
You're older than 25 now, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm 51, so I beat him.
one of the things that I found really fascinating is that global media are covering his death. This is not a U.S. phenomena. Hunter was revered and feared, as I put on my website.
Well, and a lot of the media are media that wouldn't give him space normally.
Yeah.
Right. Well, cool. Thank you very much for your contribution.
You bet. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
And watch out for Hunter Thompson's disease, folks.
And now you're on the air. Welcome.
Is that me?
It is.
Hey, well, didn't Hunter Thompson write that book about the Hell's Angels?
Yes, he did. One of his great, maybe his greatest book, in my opinion.
Well, see, I'd like to go back to 1966
mm-hmm.
when that book came out.
Yeah.
I was in eighth grade, and me and my friends in Mentone, California, which is just a few miles away from Fontana, where the Hell's Angels originated, we saw that book at the local drugstore, and we shoplifted it and passed it around and read it and discussed it and stuff. And I remember it had a pretty big influence on us. You know, the Hell's Angels are kind of legends down there, and we were young and impressionable and kind of stupid. And, you know, I mean, I don't know, you know, that year, you know, where that book had a pretty big impression on us, you know.
Hunter was sort of single-handedly responsible for the meeting of the Merry Pranksters psychedelic side of the San Francisco Bay counterculture and the bikers. I mean, he basically facilitated introducing Kesey to I forget which chapter of the Angels, I guess the Oakland Angels. And, you know, I suppose, as they say, the rest was history.
One of the greatest pieces of journalism, of someone immersing himself into his subject.
Well, and he was also grouped with Gay Talese and George Plimpton and Tom Wolfe as like the four pioneers of new journalism, and Hunter's subversion of that, pun intended, yeah, yeah, was the gonzo aspect of it.
Well, you know, a few years later, you know, the Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas came out syndicated in Rolling Stone magazine, and I had at that time a subscription to it, and I remember passing that around to all, you know, another group of friends. I graduated into, you know, the drug culture by that time, and we passed you know, the magazine around. Everybody read it, and we were pretty impressed by it, you know.
One of the greatest books to read while you're hitchhiking around the country, just reading out loud on ramps to wait for a car.
Yeah, except I usually didn't read while I was on ramps. I was too busy, you know, trying to flag.
Yeah, right.
Flag down drivers, you know.
Well, they stop.
Thank you very much for your contribution. I'm going to try and squeeze one last call in here.
All right.
Thanks. Bye. All right. Looks like you're going to be the last caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Is that me?
Sure is.
Hey, I just want to say this, that the great thing about Hunter Thompson is that in the darkest times, he was the antidote to despair, you know? And the best thing about him, I think, is that at least he could get some press. And the shocking thing hearing about this the other day was nobody's going to get press like he did. You know what I mean?
Very few.
It's going to be very difficult. But, you know, the good news is listening here, you know, a lot of people loved him, and we're going to carry on the tradition.
Oh, yeah. I certainly intend on...
I'm with you, brother.
Continuing gonzo in a journalistic, possibly, and definitely otherwise sense for a long time.
And it's all about pushing the edge. That's what it is.
Let's hear it for Gonzo Radio.
Yeah, and, you know, and he was all about no BS. When you listen to him, he was pulling your leg, but there was no BS involved in it, right?
Right.
It was the straight-ahead truth. Thanks for the program, fellas.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so we only got a couple minutes here left, and we think we're going to just bail on the calls because we actually don't have any waiting, so that's nice. Late-breaking news is that Hunter Thompson's will has a stipulation in it that he is to be cremated, and then his ashes will be
fired from a cannon.
Fired from a cannon, mm-hmm. And spread across Owl Farm.
Johnny Depp is trying to see that this happens.
Troy Hooper told Agence France-Presse, Troy Hooper being the associate editor of the Aspen Daily News. That's Hunter's style. That's how he would want it. He was a big fan of bonfires and explosions and anything that went bang, and I'm sure he'd like to go bang as well. So that's I imagine, what we can look forward to, and let's just hope that someone captures that for posterity's sake, because, well, that's a first on me. Never heard of that quite. So I'm just going to play a little bit of music here to go on out. Thank you very much to Daniel Flesses.
Certainly. And if you want to keep that behind me, I have a farewell from Ralph Steadman.
Okay, yeah, right. God, we didn't read anything from Ralph.
Well, here's Ralph. Ralph wrote this the day after, and it was published in The Guardian. I knew all along he was pretty damned important. I was naive and innocent abroad. He corrupted me in a very special way. I took his gleeful demonic spirit on board and took out of it what I needed for my own work, but he was the original. I first met him in 1970 at the Kentucky Derby. The editor of Scanlan magazine, which was named after a little-known Nottingham pig farmer, had seen my first book, Still Life with Raspberry, and concluded I was the guy to do this story with Hunter S. Thompson, an ex-Hell's Angel who just shaved his head. On the way to the airport, I lost my pens, pencils, and inks. Luckily, the editor's wife was a Revlon representative, and she gave me a pack of lipsticks and rouges and whatnot, and that's what I used for the story. The Kentucky Derby is depraved and decadent. When I finally found Hunter, he said, "Holy shit, I was told to look for a matted-haired geek with string warts." I had a goatee beard. I still don't know what string warts are, but anyway, I had them too. Well, let's have a beer, he said. Do you gamble? I told him I didn't. He'd never seen a character like me before who said, "Terrible, this is terrible," which he pronounced terrible. He realized I was looking through a glass darkly, seeing things I'd never seen before, like Southern people enjoying themselves in a weird and wonderful way. it was fresh and alien to me, so I became a conduit for him, and that's how Gonzo got started.
And just in parting, I want to read a little image here that I found at truthout.org from Hunter. Walk tall, kick ass, learn to speak Arabic, love music, and never forget that you come from a long line of truth seekers, lovers, and warriors.